Good morning, starshine. The earth says hello. You twinkle above us. We twinkle below. Good morning.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That's a bit from Good Morning Starshine, of course, by Oliver. It's familiar to many of us from the hit musical Hair.
It refers to the sun, by the way.
It does. It is the sun.
It's a morning kind of song,
but,
you know.
But right now, you with Venus in the morning. It is the brightest thing ever.
Isn't that amazing?
It really is amazing. Winter is the season for stargazing. Longer nights coupled with lower temperatures make the difference. Few among us know that better than Tom Burns, former director of the Ohio Wesleyan University Perkins Observatory. He comes back to the show today. Welcome back, Tom Burns.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Yeah.
And Fisheronians.
I actually, there was something about Venus a couple weeks ago that was so startling to me. It was so bright that I double checked to make sure that's what it was.
That it's not an alien spacecraft.
That it's not a spaceship or something out there staring at me.
A star exploding.
Yeah, I double checked. Is it brighter this year, or am I just walking a dog, a puppy in the morning?
You're just getting up, that's all. Venus is the third brightest object in the sky after the sun and Luna.
Okay. Wow. It's pretty amazing. It's amazing.
It's gorgeous.
And that's your whole thing is it's still amazing to you even after all these years of sort of doing it.
Oh, absolutely.
As avidly as you do.
You know, it's funny because I remember as a kid saying, wow, that's bright. But now I know why it's bright. And that makes it even more
amazing.
All right.
Why is it so bright?
Well, it's bright because it's close to us.
In the winter?
Generally speaking. It has a separate orbit, so that tends to vary. It's just close to us. It's actually, technically speaking, the closest planet to us. Mars might get closer occasionally. But the second thing about it is that it is covered with a very shiny, very white, very reflective layer of sulfuric acid clouds.
Ooh, nice.
It is the brightest mirror in the sky.
Okay.
To give you a comparison, the moon, which is brighter, is also much closer, but it has the reflectivity, or albedo, as astronomers like to say, the reflectivity of asphalt.
Wow.
Venus is very much, has a very much greater reflectivity than the moon does.
Wow.
So it can be, you know, 40, 50, 60 million miles away, and it's still going to shine like a beacon because of those clouds, which, by the way, never a break in those clouds. The biggest disappointment of astronomy, and believe me, I have experienced this thousands of times, is you show people Venus in a telescope, and there it is, a very bright white dot. Because you astronomers never in visual light have seen past those clouds.
Are the clouds solids?
Absolutely solid.
Then how
never
can they
a break
be clouds?
In them. Well, they are clouds.
They're clouds, but there's
they are,
never a break
they are
in them.
Sulfuric acid vapor.
So we don't know what's beneath them.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Because here's the beauty of it.
Okay.
There are certain parts of the energy spectrum that make it right through clouds. You can do radar, for instance. You put a spacecraft orbiting Venus and then do a radar. You can do infrared, which makes it nicely through clouds. And so we pretty much know at least the surface of what's underneath it. What's below the surface is going to be a mystery for a long time, because if you thought sulfuric acid clouds were bad.
Yeah.
Venus has a very thick, very dense carbon dioxide atmosphere. So dense that if you were sitting there right now, In front of your microphone, both you and your microphone would be crushed flatter than a pancake. So landing a spacecraft to, say, dig in the soil the way the latest Martian probe will do is just literally impossible. The Russians managed to land a spacecraft, one of the Venera series, and it was built like a tank, mm-hmm. and it lasted 20 minutes before wow. it was crushed. Got a couple of photographs.
What actually is crushing? It's the air pressure.
It's, you know, a greater air pressure than you would get on the bottom of the ocean, or as great an air pressure as you would get on the bottom of the ocean on Earth. Splat-o!
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR.
The goddess of love and beauty is really one of the great hellish places of the solar system. Sorry.
Beauty is only skin deep when it comes to Venus.
Well, the point is, though, you can see why the ancients identified her as the goddess of love and beauty, because she is gorgeous over there in the sky.
Truly beautiful. My guest is Tom Burns, former director of the Ohio Wesleyan University Perkins Observatory. If you have a question or comment for Tom Burns this hour, don't wait.
You
want to wait. I
call
now. Don't wait. Call now.
Before I get off on one of those monologues. And listen, you know, I have had some of my best and most spectacular and most wondrous and most life-changing experiences, freezing my butt off under those beautiful winter skies. And I'm just wondering if there's anybody out there who has had similar experiences and would like to share them. And I'm kind of hoping that some members of the Columbus Astronomical Society are listening and will softball me a few questions. Come on.
Columbus Astronomical Society, you have been petitioned to join the conversation. 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. So it's not just that the nights are longer and darker in the winter. It's that...
that's the best part, though.
It is the best part, but there's a different quality to the air.
That's right. You're going to tend... when you get a clear night in central Ohio or in Ohio in the winter, you're going to get a night of low humidity, and that's going to make the stars clear. Also, the winter skies have a preponderance of very bright stars, especially in the direction of Orion and Taurus over there in the south in the middle of the night, that makes the sky absolutely spectacular. I mean, a lot of people say that the first constellation they ever learned was the Big Dipper, mm-hmm. which is not really a constellation, but never mind. But for me, it was Orion, because you just look over there and the stars are so bright and he's fighting Taurus the Bull, and it's just a spectacular tableau. That the first view, when you know what you're looking at, is really one of those life-changing experiences.
Wait, let's go back to something. The Big Dipper?
Uh-huh.
It's not a constellation?
No. Sorry, wrong answer. It is, technically speaking, what astronomy types call an asterism, which is a collection of stars relatively close together. It's actually part of a larger defined constellation called Ursa Major,
uh-huh.
which, if you don't know Latin, means big bear, the big bear.
Uh-huh.
I just like to say that the old grocery store
got its name. Should have been called Ursa Major?
Ursa Major. Well, it got its name from that constellation.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we had it first. Thank you very much. Just like to say that for the record.
Let's see. I want to talk to Bill in Delaware. He has a good... Oh, we're waiting to get... Wait, can I get him on? Hey, Bill from Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I got a question about a green comet. There was
the Christmas comet.
About the Christmas comet.
Yeah.
And we looked for it in line with Orion's belt and really didn't see it. I don't know if it was the clouds or we were just looking in the wrong place.
Was it a giant hoax?
Were you using telescope, binoculars, naked eye? What were you doing?
Naked eye.
Well, forget about naked eye.
Yeah.
Try binoculars and try tonight. I am serious about this. It isn't much to look at. It doesn't have a tail. And it's not going to be visible to the naked eye, even if it is visible to the naked eye, but for a couple of reasons. One, from where you are observing, that is, you're too close to the cities. And secondly, there's a moon up there. You probably saw it over there when you were looking for it.
It's a half moon, though.
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter.
Whatever you call it.
The moon, the big street light in the sky. Well, and it's close, is, especially tonight. However, here's what to do. Forget about Orion. Well, start with Orion and look over to the right of Orion, and you'll see a V of stars on its side. You can't miss it. It's the V-shaped head of Taurus the Bull. And the reason you can't miss it is right above that V is that tiny little dipper-shaped collection of stars called the Pleiades or Seven Sisters. Mm-hmm. And tonight, Comet Virtanen, I can't remember.
Blah, blah. Yeah.
Is right between the V-shaped head of Taurus and the Pleiades, the Seven Sisters. So,
is this something you can see or you need binocs?
Well, you're going to need binoculars for sure. And it's going to look like a little fuzzy thing.
You know, I need binoculars to see my kid graduate. In the Schottenstein Center. How do binoculars get you to Pleiades or Pleiades?
The Pleiades. The Seven Sisters.
Yeah, I like that.
Yon Pleiades, gittering like a swarm of fireflies caught in a silver braid. That's Alfred Lord Tennyson. It looks like a little dipper of stars, very close together. Only six stars, by the way, visible to the unaided eye. And you look at it with the naked eye and you say, this is pretty cool. But then you look at it in binoculars.
And it makes that much
difference. The area explodes into about a dozen stars.
Okay.
More if you have, young, strong eyes.
Oh,
wow. But still, you're going to like it.
No,
trust me.
Okay.
Now, then you say, well, this is going to look great in a telescope. But the problem with the Pleiades is, to give you an idea of how small an area a telescope is looking at, it's too big for a telescope, even at low magnification. The whole thing won't fit in. So I tell people, they say, I'm going to buy a telescope for Christmas. I say, try binoculars first, because there are a lot of things that look great in binoculars, and there are a few things that are at their best in binoculars. You like those? Go on to a telescope.
So, telescopes can go farther, but they can't go wider, proportionately wider.
Telescopes, by their nature, are designed to do two things. One is to gather a lot of light so they can see dimmer.
Okay.
That's their main goal, is to see dimmer. That's why we always say with telescopes, it's aperture, the size of the lens or the mirror that's gathering the lights, that's important. The bigger you got, the more you can see. Distance is a matter of magnification, and you do that by changing the eyepiece on the telescope like you would on a microscope. So that you're really, you can see farther because the farther things are dimmer. But by virtue of magnification, when you're magnifying, you're looking at a smaller area of the image. So that telescopes magnify, they also show a smaller area of sky, the more they're magnifying. But the nice thing about binoculars is that they're designed to see a wide field. So a pair of 50-millimeter binoculars, that's with two lenses each 2 inches in diameter, is generally designed to work at about 7 power so that you can see the most of anything you're looking at.
Okay. We are going to take a quick break. My guest is Tom Burns, former director of the Ohio Wesleyan University Perkins Observatory, talking about what you can see in the night sky this winter. And it's a lot more, actually, than you can see in the summer. The nights are longer, they're darker, and there's a... You know, it's a different sky than the sun.
It is
summer,
a different sky.
So there's a lot of different stuff to see. So coming up, if you have questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance need the cover.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. That's a bit from, of course, Moon Dance by Van Morrison. Today we're talking about stars, planets, moons, and other celestial objects in the winter night sky. Still with us, former director of the Ohio Wesleyan University Perkins Observatory, Tom Burns. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Josh. He says he lives in downtown Columbus. He's looking to get into stargazing. He asked about the binoculars versus the telescopes. You just answered that question before our break. He says, as far as urban stargazing, will a metro park suffice, my back porch, or should I get out of the city?
Well, I always recommend getting out of town. Get out of town before sunset, because you're always going to get better, darker skies. And especially if you decided to buy a telescope. Inside the city, you're going to be able to see some bright planets and the moon, and then you are going to be stuck. I've done a lot of programs both ways, and done a lot of programs at metro parks over the years. And after, if there's a bright planet or the moon, you show that. And after that, you're pretty much stuck to double stars, binary star systems. And once you've seen one double star, you've seen them all. Well, there are exceptions, I suppose. But it really does pay to get out of town, which is why Perkins is great. The skies are still relatively decent there. But also, if you're going to go to a program, if you're just going to choose one program to go to, you need to get down to the new John Glenn Astronomy Park run by a good buddy of mine, Brad Haney, run by the Hawking Hills, the Friends of the Hawking Hills. Mm-hmm. And it is just dark down there compared to, say, inside the city. And it takes a telescope and turns it into an instrument that you can see thousands of objects with instead of just three.
Okay.
And the biggest telescope in the world from inside Columbus is really just going to be limited in its ability to show you the sky.
Because of all the darn light we
have. Get out of town by sunset.
Get out of town. All right. Mike in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Ann. Hey, Sean. Well, before I get to my question, I have some unfinished business with Tom. My friend, I have a...
Mike, hate to interrupt you, but you're very muffled sounding.
I've got the phone to my face. I'm not sure what the problem is, and I'm in a stopped vehicle. Any better?
This is better, yes.
Yes.
Well, Tom, you've left a lot of families with a lot of really happy and pleasant memories. I was just thinking about all the summers I took my kids up to listen to your presentations at Perkins, and 20 years has slipped by. Anyway, thank you for that. You have a bigger impression on the community than you realize. My question is this.
Thank you.
My wife is dying to see the Northern Lights, and I recall seeing them as a kid out on Lake Erie on the back deck of my dad's boat. Is it ever possible to see the Northern Lights from Ohio, except in the middle of Lake Erie?
Yes, it is. And you don't have to usually, when it happens, you don't have to go to the middle of Lake Erie to do it. One of my fondest memories is taking the trash out to the can one night, looking up and seeing the sky filled with aurorae. I said, "Hey," I woke everybody up. I said, "Hey, we're getting in the car." And thus we did, in our pajamas, drive north to the Richland Astronomical Society site. And in other words, it's possible, but it depends on increased solar activities. And that's hard to come by these days. We're just past solar minimum, it's called. And even solar maximum was just a real drag. I mean, you'd look at the sun and there were no sunspots. None. And when there are a lot of sunspots, that tends to create a lot of solar activity, the radiation and the particle radiation from the sun. And that's what causes the aurora. So here is my suggestion. Check out spaceweather.com. That's one word, spaceweather.com. And look for they'll do a kind of dense particle density in space of protons. And when the proton count comes to 9 per cubic centimeter, then that might be a time to go out and look and see if you can see an aurora. But the farther north you get, the better. But I would only go out if there was a distinct chance of an aurora. Auroras tend to be fairly short. That is, they'll only happen for a few hours. And sometimes you'll get high proton density, which causes a really beautiful aurora. And it's not daytime here. It's nighttime on the other side of there getting a great aurora.
Right, right.
But there is one solution where you can be guaranteed, almost guaranteed, to see an aurora. Every October, there are cruises that leave from the West Coast, and they go up the coast to Alaska. Mm-hmm. And these are aurora cruises. Their primary goal, I mean, they'll stop at Fairbanks too, you know. But their primary goal is to let you see the aurora borealis. And, you know, up north around the Arctic Circle, there's always an aurora of some sort. As a matter of fact, the people up in Alaska hate them. They interfere with the other observing, you know.
Interesting.
You don't point a telescope at some faint object, there's an aurora in the way.
The only time I've ever seen it that I was aware of, because sometimes it's there and you're just not aware that that's what it is, but because it's so faint down here, much more faint, but it was when I was backpacking up on Isle Royale in Lake Superior, mm-hmm. and I got up in the middle of the night to go to the outhouse.
Well, middle of the night.
Yeah, and I just looked up, and it was this. I just remember it was like shimmering. The whole sky was shimmering green. It was a green one. Now I've seen other kinds of aurora borealis that is multicolored.
Well, that's right, and it depends.
Mine wasn't, but
when those charged particles hit the atmosphere, they get pulled by Earth's magnetic field up to the poles and then shot down through the atmosphere. And when they're hitting an oxygen, it might be their way around. When they're hitting an oxygen atom or molecule, they glow red. When they're hitting a nitrogen atom, they glow green. Hmm. And there's a lot more nitrogen than there is oxygen.
But so that's more common.
Yeah. But in a really powerful set of aurorae, you're going to get red and green mostly. Okay. I've seen them covering the whole sky.
Right. Yeah.
From Central Ohio.
Okay. Mike in Upper Arlington, thanks for that call. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest, Tom Burns, former director of Ohio Wesleyan University Perkins Observatory, came to join us before the holidays. A lot of people are going to have a little bit more time over the holidays maybe to stay up late and enjoy the night sky. Fingers crossed we have some clear nights. I know we have one tonight, so I'm pretty sure. Maybe I spoke too soon, but I thought we did. So this is a great thing to do with the kids over the holiday. Get them to sleep in. Hey, do it on Christmas Eve, you know, and then maybe they'll sleep in. on Christmas morning.
And I have to say, tonight, even if it's partly cloudy, it's worth standing outside for an hour
waiting for the crowds to roll in.
You better believe it. I have not seen this comet yet. I have just gotten it. This weather's been terrible.
It's been the gloomiest.
And so I am going to take the opportunity that God and nature have given me to go see this comet. And this is what is important to realize about winter observing, folks. You don't say to yourself, I have to work tomorrow, or, I don't feel like it, or, I'm tired, I have an ingrown toenail. Mm-hmm. When you get a clear night, you go out because there are so precious few of them.
Dale in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Dale.
Hi. I had a question about the Chippenham sculpture over the front door of the observatory.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, the
what kind of sculpture?
The stone carving sculpture over the front door.
Oh, yes. I know it well.
It's gorgeous. Well, phenomenal work. I'm a stone carver myself. I was curious, you know, where it was made or what the story behind that sculpture is. It's fantastic.
What is it, first of all?
Very weirdly, I mean, for a place of science, it is the charioteer, the sun god. His job is to carry the sun across the sky in a golden chariot pulled mm-hmm. by horses. It is him watering his horses after a long, hot, sweaty day of carrying
dragging
the sun across the sky. The old story is that Helios, we still use that word, by the way, heliocentric, sun-centric, mm-hmm. as realizing that this was pretty hot work, especially for the horses, has dipped a big old clamshell in the water and is watering his horses. It is a copy of the sculpture above the horse stables at Versailles.
Well, there you go.
Except theirs is flat. Ours is curved. And I do get art students come from all over the world, in fact. I used to, I don't do so much anymore.
Right.
Just to see that sculpture. And I wish I could give them more details. But it was carved and then molded. We still have the molds up in the attic of the observatory. And then poured concrete and then placed into position. The name of the artist and all that razzmatazz had been lost in the inky depths of the Perkins files. I'm sure it must be there someplace.
Dale, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Natalie in Hartsgrove, you're on the air. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I had a question about binoculars, but first I wanted to address a previous caller who was asking about the Northern Lights in Ohio. And years ago, I think it was around 2001, 2002 maybe, I was lying outside at night in the summertime watching the most brilliant meteor shower I've ever seen and fell asleep and woke up a couple hours later, so maybe I'm guessing 2 or 3 in the morning, woke up. And when I opened my eyes, the sky all around was filled with brilliant, brilliant curtains and shimmering movement of all different colors.
Wow.
Did you see any rosettes? That is, those little spiral-shaped ones?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. You know what? The one that I said was 1999, that was the 2001 one. I got the date wrong.
Okay.
But yeah, I saw the same one. Beautiful.
Yeah, well, I didn't know what I was looking at, so I was scared half to death. I thought the world was ending or something, you know, the nuclear plant had gone up or something until about maybe 20 seconds later, I'm, you know, lying there looking at it, and I thought, oh, I wonder if this is the Northern Lights.
Wow.
And then it turned out, so a little bit of hope for that caller. Yes, you can, in fact, see that. Rarely, I guess, but in Ohio.
Well, more rarely lately because of the lack of solar activity, but that's bound to change.
Yeah.
It might take 10 years, but keep looking up and check spaceweather.com.
Okay. And Natalie, you had a question?
Yes, about binoculars. why is it that, you know, on the ground, if I'm, you know, doing wildlife watching or, you know, whatever, I can focus my binoculars up to a certain distance, and then beyond that, I can't sharpen an image. You know, in other words, I cannot sharpen an image a mile away mm-hmm. with my binoculars. But if I'm looking up at the night sky at stars or planets that are bazillions of miles away, mm-hmm. I can sharpen that image.
Yeah. That's what I don't understand.
Yeah. I don't understand
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I don't get that.
Tom. Does anybody know?
I've never had that problem, but binoculars do. When you're looking at the sky, you are focusing at infinity. That is, you know, the technical photographic term, because it really is an infinity. And I've never had trouble getting, unless they were bad binoculars, getting a pair of binoculars to focus. But here I think is what you may be noticing. When you're doing something just like looking at stars, you're not going to notice the kind of aberrations that you get in the optics that you might notice. So it's not really a matter, I think, maybe of focus so much as it is a quality of the quality of the optics that you are using, which will tend to work better at close range, and you'll start noticing more aberrations in the optics at longer ranges. And at infinity, a good eye, I mean, one that's trained to look at things in infinity might notice those aberrations too. But when you're looking at stars, it's hard to see them. Like I will see in a bad pair of binoculars that I've noticed doesn't work well at a great distance. I'll notice that there, when I look at a star, there's a slight flaring in one direction. And that is a sign to me of two possible problems. One is that your binoculars are astigmatic. And that the same problem that you might have with your eye. But secondly, or one side or the other is astigmatic. But more likely, they're just, they're not well aligned. That is, that you have a collimation problem with the binoculars. That used to be easy to fix because there were a lot of people who knew how to collimate binoculars, but it's not so easy
anymore.
You can't
get anyone to fix your toaster.
There was one
days.
Guy in Columbus 10 years ago, but he retired. And
there's not enough people fixing stuff. Natalie, I hope that answered your question. Thanks for calling. Anybody else? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's no wait right now, so don't wait. We'll be right back with Tom Burns, former director of the Ohio Wesleyan University Perkins Observatory. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
With the stars above in your eyes, fantabulous night to make romance. Need the cover of October skies. With all the leaves on the trees are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow. Yeah, I'm trying to please to the calling of your heart strength that plays soft and low.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. And let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. And that's, of course, from Fly Me to the Moon, performed by Frank Sinatra.
In other words, darling, kiss me.
Today we're talking about stars, planets, moons, and other celestial objects in the winter night sky. My guest is former director of Ohio Wesleyan University, Perkins Observatory, Tom Burns. Are you going to quit your day job and start singing? that's the question that inquiring minds would like to know.
Only if I want to be thrown in prison or
starved
otherwise
to death.
Isolated no. from the rest of the world.
There are some highlights you mentioned earlier. The winter sky, the Andromeda Galaxy.
Ah, yes.
The Great Nebula in Orion, which you mentioned earlier. the winter Milky Way, star clusters in Cassiopeia, and the Christmas Comet. The Andromeda Galaxy. Where's that?
Well, right now, it's getting to be almost straight overhead. Okay. And let's see, what constellation is it in? I can't remember. Oh, yes.
Do we need to know our constellations, right?
Well, to some degree, yeah. Especially if you're observing from inside the city. But you're looking at Andromeda, which is just to the left of the Great Square of Pegasus, and getting pretty high in the sky right now. And from dark rural skies, you'll see this tiny little cigar-shaped fuzzy patch of light, very easy in binoculars, mm-hmm. even from inside from suburban skies. And when you look at it, you are looking at the farthest thing that the unaided human eye can behold. You are seeing at the greatest distance your eyes are capable of seeing. 2.5 million light years. 1 light year is 6 trillion miles. Let's see. That's 6 trillion. That's 12 zeros times 2,500,000, mm-hmm. which would be, excuse me for a moment, carry mm-hmm. the zero. Really far away. In other words, it took the light 2.5 million years to get to your eyeballs, and you are seeing another galaxy. You are seeing a galaxy very much like your own Milky Way at a great distance from you. It's like looking in a cosmic mirror.
How can we see the winter Milky Way? I mean, how we're in it?
Well, the same way you can see the summer Milky Way, we're in it, but we're out near the edge of it. Mm-hmm. So that when you look up at the sky, the stars that you're seeing that aren't on to the left and the right of the Milky Way are stars where you're looking kind of away from the center of the Milky Way. And then when you see that silvery band of light stretching across the sky, you're looking into the depth of the Milky Way. Way of good thinking about this, it's like you're a bug inside a Frisbee.
Okay.
So when you're looking away from the Milky Way, you're looking at the Frisbee toward the plastic up above and below the Frisbee.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
And then when you're looking at the Milky Way, the bright part of the Milky Way, you're looking into the center of the Frisbee. So that we can see the Milky Way because we are in it. And it just, when we're looking into the brighter part of it that we see as the silvery band, we're looking into the Milky Way. Thank goodness we are out near the edge of the Milky Way. And so we can see it that way.
Brian in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Tom, I got a quick question. What would you suggest to try making some improvements to Google Sky Maps?
The improvement that I would make in Google Sky Maps is go out and buy a good set of sky maps. That is, you know, the only way I use the kind of app-based sky maps is when I want to prove to somebody that really is Jupiter over there. When I'm really trying to find something that I have never found before mm-hmm. in a telescope, I use real, honest-to-God, made-out-of-paper star charts.
The old-fashioned,
they're just a whole lot easier to use. But, you know, Google Sky Maps are good as far as they go. You can zoom in. What I like to do is, you know, zoom into what would be kind of the general constellational area around an object mm-hmm. and print it. And here's the trick, zoom in to an area, usually depending on the finder on your telescope, about 2 degrees in diameter, and then print that. And then draw a little circle that kind of marks out what your finder is going to see around that object. And that way you can get a pretty good idea of pointing. But, you know, I just the way I tend to use those star maps, that's the way I would use them if I didn't have real paper star maps to use. By the way, if you have paper star maps, you find out what the field of view of your finder is, and then you get a piece of cardboard and you cut out a hole that size. That way you can look at the whole map, and that way, after you've looked at the whole map, you can lay that piece of cardboard onto the map so that you have a hole that shows the exact field of your little finder telescope on the side of your telescope.
Brian, thanks for that call. We have an email from Marty who says that he loves Tom, first of all.
Thank you. I love you, too.
Where is the closest dark sky park to us? Is that the Hocking Hills?
That would, I guess, the closest place that is dedicated to that kind of astronomy is Perkins Observatory, at least from the central Ohio area. The closest place that is truly dedicated to keeping its sky dark and has the power and the will to do it, and by the way, is also surrounded by the Hocking State Forest and the State Park, is JGAP, the John Glenn Astronomy Park.
Okay.
I have been spending a lot of time down there and some time at Perkins, too, but mostly down there because you can't beat those dark skies. Right. They aren't the darkest skies in Ohio because of the city of Logan and also, I might add, Columbus, which is still only an hour and 15 minutes away. Mm-hmm. But it's the best you're going to do, and have a place dedicated to astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is open 24/7, by the way, if you want to just go there, drive up, park your car, and sit on a lawn chair and look at the wonder and majesty of the universe you live in, the way God and nature intended you to see it before all these streetlights and billboard lights got put in.
Thanks for that email from Marty. And if you have a question or comment for Tom Burns, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We're talking about the beauty, the majesty of the night sky, the winter night
Your
sky.
Your universe, my friend.
Your universe.
Of which you are a very small part, but you share.
You are indeed
a part.
In its
wonder, you share in its grand size because you are the only part of the universe who can appreciate that wonder and that beauty and that grand scale.
That we know of, yeah.
That we know of.
You wanted to talk about the calendar. We try to kind of think we've kind of got everything under control with our calendars, right? And our watches and all that kind of stuff.
It involves messing with the leap years every 4 years, every 40 years, every 400 years.
But
things change. But other than that, pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a mess. I mean, think about this. What you have is the calendar is based on three basic sets of astronomical events. You have Earth's rotation. You have the revolution of the moon around the Earth, and then you have the revolution of the Earth around the sun. These time periods do not divide equally into each other in any way, shape, or form. So you can't have a month that's 28.3 days long. Won't happen to you. And you can't have a year that's 365 days long or 12 months long without adding days to months and all of that, and it's just a mess. But the point is that the ancients did not demand that kind of accuracy.
It's us.
It's us, and we are so time-driven. I mean, what would have happened if I'd shown up at 10:15? You would be cursing my name forever.
You'd
fire me. That's right. Mm-hmm. And we are so time-driven that we require all these manipulations. But the thing that gets to me every time is that people are constantly asking me, well, why isn't the latest sunrise on December 21st, the solstice? Why is it on December 4th? And, you know, because they think that there's something magical about that date, December 21st. The way we measure time is an illusion. It is a set of compromises. And so we put this winter solstice on December 21st, but sometimes it's December 22nd, by the way. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with these it has very little to do with these astronomical events. So that the latest sunrise is on December 4th because Earth's orbit around the sun is not a perfect circle, and because Earth speeds up as it approaches the sun when it reaches its closest point in January.
So are the days already getting longer then? Is that what you're telling me?
No. Okay. Because like it or not, that is December 21st or 22nd, depending.
Yeah.
Is indeed the shortest day of the year. That because the year is the one thing that the calendar measures pretty well except for that pesky quarter of a day.
Okay.
But that isn't even right, by the way. The quarter, it's not quite a quarter of a day, or it might be a little more than a quarter of a day. In any case, we have to add and subtract leap years every 40 and 400 years to account for that tiny fraction that it isn't the quarter of a day. In any case, the year is basically right. It's everything else that's screwed up.
NASA's InSight lander arrived on Mars last month to study that planet's deep interior and how it was formed. What do you think about stuff like that? I mean, what are your expectations? What are you looking for?
Well, you know, my expectation is that they will find out stuff. And I don't know what that stuff is, and that's what's so cool about it. Everybody's always saying, every time we send one of these things, they create new questions. Ooh, that's the coolest part of it.
It's manna from heaven.
But my expectation is that they will find out more about Mars. This will eventually prepare, I suppose, for a human trip to Mars. But my greatest joy in this is that we're able to do it without going to the expense and the difficulty of sending human beings there. Because, you know, as much as space geeks like me are supposed to really be think about or and be enamored of the magnificence of sending humans into space, I look around me and I see people starving in Yemen, and it's a fraction. You can do this kind of research for a fraction of the cost and gain just the same results, and that is what is magnificent to me. You know what else is magnificent to me about this? Most of the times they try to land on Mars, they crash. It's really, really hard.
Why is that?
Well, first of all, it was easier to land on the moon because the moon is only one quarter the gravity of Mars.
Okay,
so, you know, that's one thing. And you're screaming at incredible speeds to get to Mars, and you have to slow down. And Mars has an atmosphere, even if it's a thin one, and that creates problems. But so most of the time, these things crash. But here's the biggest problem. If you're talking about real time, something's going wrong, you can make corrections, right? You can say, oh, my gosh, it's going too fast. Let's bump up the thrusters a little bit. With the moon, that's easy. It's only 1 second away by radio.
Right.
Well, Mars, even at its closest, is 14 minutes away.
Right.
So they start the automatic functions and then hope nothing goes wrong.
Right.
And it's hard to build in a lot of redundant systems, too, because, you know, you're costing billions of dollars to send these things as it is. So, yes, they crash a lot. So the very fact that it landed is miracle enough for me. Thank you very much.
Tom Burns, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. And folks, this Christmas season, look up. If you want to know, if you worship at Christmas, know what Psalm 19, verse 1 and 2 say, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork."
That's Tom Burns, former director of the Ohio Wesleyan University Perkins Observatory. Thanks so much for your attention today. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In other words,